From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. What went wrong in Benghazi? Should the U.S. be more actively supporting the opposition forces in Syria? How can a failed state across the globe pose a threat to us here? Up ahead, a conversation with Richard Haass, the president of the Influential Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Richard Haass has led the Council on Foreign Relations for 10 years. Previously, he was a principal advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell, U.S. coordinator for policy toward the future of Afghanistan, and U.S. envoy to the Northern Ireland peace process. He's also been a special assistant to the first President Bush, and he's even been a legislative aide in the U.S. Senate. Dr. Haass's latest book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order, scheduled to be published this month. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
So if you've got a question about foreign affairs, he's the guy to ask. 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. Outside our area, 800-289-5869. Write to us, conversation at KUOW.org. Dr. Haass, just a few moments ago, we were hearing from the BBC Middle East correspondent about the chaos in Syria. What do you think the U.S. role is in ending this conflict?
Well, I'm not sure this is a conflict that can easily be ended. Even at some point, if the opposition succeeds in ousting the regime, that's simply the end of phase one. And then you begin what could be something as bloody, if not bloodier and more prolonged, where the opposition essentially then fights for their vision of the future of Syria. For all those reasons and others, I think the United States ought to be involved, but with a ceiling on our involvement. So I support various forms of aid to the opposition. I'd even favor selective lethal aid if we knew and trusted the people. Obviously, massive help for the probably 1 million plus refugees. But I do not want to see direct U.S. military involvement simply because I think the costs would far outweigh any benefits.
You inserted the caveat, if we knew and trusted. And there's a lot about the opposition forces that we have reason to be suspicious of, their desire to impose Sharia law, possible atrocities they may have committed. Are we ever going to get to the point where we'll know and trust them to the degree that we would give them lethal weapons or more active support?
Maybe small numbers of individuals, but your point's totally legitimate. Again, a lot of the opposition is wildly unattractive, whether it's Sharia law, ties to al-Qaeda, what have you. So again, we've got to be quite discriminating in what it is we do. We also have to understand that as bad as Mr. Assad was and is, the alternatives are not necessarily better. This is a Middle East where you may have no good options.
What about the idea of just slow playing this and assuming that the opposition or Assad will come out on top eventually and it'll be settled one way or the other without any kind of active engagement?
The problem with that is on a humanitarian level, it's awful. Probably close to 100,000 people have already lost their lives. Damascus was one of the great capitals of the Arab world. It's got a sensational history. Anyone who's been there knows what a beautiful country Syria is. So simply to be cynical and to allow it to burn out, well, that could literally take years. So that's not a very attractive option either.
There's some strong evidence that the Boston Marathon bombers were inspired at least by jihadists. And you've said we're apt to see more of that. Why?
Well, in part because of how widespread or prevalent the internet is. People now can get inspired from all sorts of things, and it only takes a tiny percentage of people, if you will, a handful, can make a real difference. We're living in an age of decentralized power, where small groups or small numbers of individuals can have disproportionate power of access, whether it's to the internet, to money, to weapons of various sort. So I think we have to get used to it, particularly in a relatively open society such as the United States. I was on a TV show right after the Boston bombing with the head of the New York City Police, Ray Kelly. And his reaction was he was surprised that something like this hadn't happened a lot sooner in a city like New York. And I think that's what all of us think.
Many are trying to insert the Boston Marathon bombing and the origins of the two suspected bombers into the immigration debate mm-hmm. to say we need to look more closely before we make any changes. What do you think?
Not a lot. Just the opposite, actually. We've got 11 or 12 million people in this country, as you and your listeners know, living in the shadows. What we want to do is integrate all Americans as fully as we can into the mainstream of society. Why do we want to leave people living this life on the margins? They're much more vulnerable then. For help coming from the outside, quote-unquote help, to radicalization. The real threat to me is less in terrorists coming from abroad a la 9/11, but it's people who are homegrown. That's a much more dangerous threat ultimately to the core of American society. We ought to want to integrate as many Americans as fully as we can, as quickly as we can. So I actually think that argues for immigration reform on that front more broadly, if you're looking to promote economic growth in this country, just look historically. Look at the Fortune magazine just came out with their top 500 issue. It's interesting how many of those companies were founded and developed by people who came here from abroad. That's one of the great drivers of American society. So what we ought to do is double or triple the number of people here on green cards, H-1B visas. This ought to be now part and parcel of our economic growth strategy.
Dr. Richard Haass is my guest. He's been leading the Council on Foreign Relations for a decade, and his new book out this month, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order. Last September 11th, Ambassador Chris Stevens and three of his staff members were killed in an attack on the U.S. consulate in the Libyan city of Benghazi. And in Washington, D.C., there's a firestorm over the way that this was handled, or as the critics say, mishandled. What's your take on this?
Well, the foreign policy take, which is slightly different than the Washington conversation, is it shows how dangerous Libya was and still is. People thought that Libya was a quote-unquote success, but it's a reminder that simply getting rid of a tyrannical regime, in this case Gaddafi, didn't mean that peace and prosperity and democracy were about to break out all over. And now large parts of Libya are a wild west, no man's land, and lots of the problems of Libya have now spread into parts of Africa. It's just a reminder that all of these interventions are tougher than people think and have all sorts of unexpected or unforeseen consequences. Look, I've worked in the State Department. And I've worked at the White House. I've been involved in hundreds of meetings about putting together talking points. What clearly happened, I think, up front is the State Department didn't take all the steps they could have taken to protect the ambassador and our facilities out there. And, you know, what we don't know is exactly why people made some bad judgments. That's the sort of thing that people under pressure, time pressure to make decisions, limited resource. Sometimes you make bad calls. Fair enough. The big question is whether, again, talking points or public presentation was in any way manipulated for political purposes. I simply think we don't know. So my sense is stand back, let it play out, look into it. In the meantime, this is probably now in third place given the other scandals that are running around Washington. But you always want to look at these things seriously. You never want serious foreign policy, national security questions politicized. On the other hand, you don't want to rush to judgment and you don't want to assume necessarily the worst.
If you've got a question about U.S. foreign policy, ask Dr. Richard Haass. He leads the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been involved in diplomacy at the very highest levels of the U.S. government for many, many years. We're at 206-543-5869, 800-289-5869. Write to us, conversation@kuow.org. You've written about how no great rival directly threatens the U.S. interests today, but we don't know how long that's going to last. What are the likely threats?
Well, that's the big goal of American foreign policy, to let what I would call this respite, this break in international relations, a departure from history. We want to prolong this as long as we can. So sure, we've got threats out there. We've got the Iran nuclear program. We've got North Korea. We've got situations like Syria that you and I have been talking with. There's climate change. There's any number of challenges or threats out there, but there's nothing remotely on the scale, say, of Nazi Germany during the middle of the 20th century or the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So one of the things we want to do is try to prevent such a threat from coming about. And interestingly enough, the best way to do it is to focus more here at home. If we renew the foundations of American power, our economy, and all that flows from it, that'll put us in a position to discourage anybody from challenging us, China or anybody else. And if I'm wrong, and if someone's all the same, decides to challenge us, it'll position us much better to deal with it. So for me, we ought to take advantage of the fact that we don't have anyone out there who really can play on the same field as us and use this to repair all the things that you and I know need repairing here at home.
But why does America's failure to invest in infrastructure make us weaker abroad? I mean, who's going to challenge us because our bridges are crumbling?
Well, in two ways. One is it makes us much less competitive economically. It's a real subtractor from American economic performance. It's wildly inefficient. So there's that. Second of all, it also makes us much more vulnerable to terrorism. If we had more modern, more resilient terrorism, redundant parts and so forth, things built from the latest materials, we would be much more robust as a society to bounce back from inevitable attacks. But the real reason to repair our infrastructure, besides the short-term benefit of jobs, is to make us much more economically competitive. And if we grow at a higher level, and by the way, we're only growing at a half to two-thirds the post-World War II level, if we can grow at our historic levels, that'll generate resources, which among other things will give us all that we need militarily, economically, diplomatically to continue to lead the world.
You've talked about how we should maybe be less concerned about our large rivals and more concerned about failed states around the world. I want to get to that latter point in a moment. But there are many debating what the future of the United States will be vis-a-vis China. Will the U.S. become the second world power? Where do you see that going?
Say two things. One is people tend to simply look at how China's grown the last three decades, and then they continue the lines, and they assume the next three decades are going to go the same way. No way. A lot of the low-hanging fruit has been picked. China has enormous environmental problems, as we've all been reading about. It's got certain political problems. There's somewhere between 1 and 200,000 sizable political protests in China every year. So I think China, at best, is going to hit enormous speed bumps. Secondly, I don't assume that the U.S.-Chinese relationship necessarily turns out bad. I think it's manageable. It's a challenge to Chinese diplomats, to American diplomats. All I'd say is it's probably, you know, on anyone's short list of the most important relationships of the 21st century. If we end up in an adversarial Cold War relationship, it is a bad thing. We won't be then able to cooperate. We're not going to be partners, but we should be able to be something in between.
You know, we couldn't talk about U.S.-China relations without talking about Taiwan in previous decades, but that issue seems to be sidelined.
To some extent, the Chinese have learned to live with, if you will, the ambiguity of Taiwan. And I think there's a sense that one way or another, the two countries will become more fully integrated. In the meantime, China is much more worried about problems on the mainland. United States is much more worried about things like the situation, say, in North Korea. And both China and the United States are worried, say, about Chinese relationship with Japan. Indeed, one of the most interesting things is while Americans are fixated on the Middle East, the tectonic plates of Asia are moving. And suddenly Japan, China, India, South Korea, there's a sense that history is returning with a vengeance. And whereas we haven't had to worry about this part of the world for decades, we've all been happy to watch it grow merrily. Well, suddenly now we've got to worry about the political military, the potential for instability in Asia.
Dr. Richard Haass is my guest. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Kim is on the line. She's listening to us today on Queen Anne Hill. Kim, what's your question or comment?
Yes, Dr. Haass, I'd like to say that, I support our president, but I am disturbed by our use of drones. And while they may be very effective, we've also killed civilians. And it isn't, it's easy for me to imagine living in the third world and being afraid of these things in the sky. And I'd like to hear you on the subject. Are we maybe doing more harm than good?
Look, it's a great question, and it's a tight calculus. Don Rumsfeld, who when he was Secretary of Defense, once wrote an interesting memo saying, when we do things to go after terrorists, he asks exactly your question. Are we killing more terrorists than essentially we're generating? And that's the question we have to ask ourselves with drones, because whenever there's quote-unquote collateral damage, which is a fancy phrase for killing innocent people, we obviously alienate populations, governments, and societies. So I would simply say drones have to be used, but they have to also be an exceptional instrument. You should only use them when you're really confident that you've got a high-value target, when there's no better way to do it, when you are confident that you can carry out the attack with little or no collateral damage. So my own view is not to ban them, but it's also not to use them probably as frequently as we have, but to somewhat roll that back.
Do we do enough post-operation analysis to see whether the strikes meet those criteria?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer about the details of a post-strike analysis. I would simply say that talking to a lot of people, my sense is we've used them a little bit too often, in part because we're there's two reasons besides the prevalence of terrorists. One is that local governments are often unwilling or unable to act. The other is we're wary often of sending in our own special forces. So drones are an instrument that fill a very real need. And like most things in life, the question is how to get it just right.
Kim, thanks for your call. North Korea recently sentenced a man from Lynnwood, a Korean-American man, Kenneth Bett, to 15 years of hard labor for allegedly proselytizing his religion. And there's speculation that the North Koreans want to use Bett as a bargaining chip to get a high-level U.S. visit. What do you think is going on here?
Quite possibly. Everything North Korea does tends to be for bargaining chips. I actually think it does something. It threatens to do things, or it actually does something, and it's hoping that by yelling loud enough, it gets some attention. But when Bob Gates, who lives out here, was Secretary of Defense, his basic view was, let's not reward this. You know, we've sold this horse several times now. We've given them sanctions sanctions relief for promises, say, about their nuclear program. So my view of North Korea is to hang back a bit. And it's interesting, in this last quote-unquote crisis over the last, what, 6 weeks, 2 months, the North Koreans made a lot of threats. The United States and the world didn't react. Presumably China twisted their arms, because only China is in a position to do that. About two-thirds of North Korea's trade goes in and out of China. And basically, the North Koreans quieted down. So I take that as a useful learning experience.
Finally, what's your grade on the Obama administration and foreign affairs? Where are they doing well? Where are they doing poorly?
Well, the cop-out is to say incomplete. I won't do that. Look, what I like is the basic strategic thrust, a drawing down to some extent from the Middle East. I objected to the buildup in Afghanistan, but now we're, I think, moving in the right direction. We're not withdrawing, but we're putting a limit on what we're doing. I like the fact that we're doing more in the Asia-Pacific, where the great powers potentially collide. My biggest problem with their foreign policy, finally enough, is their domestic policy, which in part is why I wrote the book. The president did things like create the Simpson-Bowles Commission to deal with the deficit, and then it got orphaned as soon as it was created. And very little is happening to really restore the bases of American economic power. In the long run, that's the prerequisite for American national security. So my biggest national security problems have less to do with foreign policy than they do with domestic policy, which again is why I wrote this book.
And the book, which is out this month, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order. Dr. Richard Haass is the author. He also is president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, Ross.
It's KUOW, Seattle.